I think we'll start the meeting here. We don't have a quorum yet to officially start, but I think we'll start with the testimony, and we do have Senator Mary Olson is joining us today, and she has to be at another meeting, so we're going to put her at the top of the agenda, along with Representative Moe for carrying the Star Lake legislation, and that would be, we got that right here. Oh, there it is, House File 3437, and we just start the testimony, and then we'll officially begin after a quorum is met. So welcome, Representative Moe, and if you'd like to start, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's good to see you again. It's been several hours. I'd like to, we'll move this as soon as we have a quorum. I'd like to introduce the Star Lake and River Program, and this is the idea primarily of Senator Mary Olson, but it's one of the very good ideas, and I hopefully the success stories come out of these sessions. Many of the issues that we've been working on here in this committee, however, the last few years that we've been here together, is to try to come up with strategies to clean up our lakes and rivers, but also giving tools to lakeshore associations, tools in the toolbox. There you go, write that down. tools to lakeshore associations and citizens to actually help themselves clean their own lakes and rivers, working with our state agencies to do so. This kind of puts that all together. It actually allows lakeshore associations to work with our state agencies, PCA, Soil and Water Conservation District, DNR, to come up with a lake or river management plan, and then reward them by giving them a Star Lake designation in order to actually, once they start making progress on that management plan. It's a carrot approach. It's not punitive in nature, but allows lakes to capitalize on their strengths and clean things up without the state of Minnesota having to hit them over the head in order to require them to do so. I see a lot of spin-off benefits for this. As many of us work on tourism, it's extremely important to the economy of our areas. Assuming that it is somewhat rigorous to attain a Star Lake designation, then it would be obviously beneficial for lakes and lake areas to advertise themselves as Star Lakes. Also for real estate purposes, increasing property value, all sorts of other benefits to having a program like this in place. With that, I'm going to introduce my Senator Mary Olson, who has been working on this long before I came aboard and asked off Rittenhouse. Senator?
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe. I'd first like to thank you for inviting me to be here as a witness today. It's really an honor, the first time I've ever been here, to been given the opportunity to testify in the other body, and that's really a privilege for me. So thank you for having me here today. As Representative Moe, and I really appreciate his support of this bill. Really, this was a joint effort in putting this language together, and his encouragement and his knowledge of environmental issues far exceeds mine. I'm not sitting on any environmental committees on the Senate side, but both Representative Moe and I represent an area that has a very high concentration of lakes and a large number of lake associations. And so just by the nature of the job that we do, we have a lot of interaction with people who are very passionate about the health of their lakes and have committed a lot of their own personal time and resources to making sure that they have healthy lakes. This idea came about because of the position I'm in as a senator for an area like this. I had a lot of contact over the last year from lake associations, and they had a number of different concerns. Some of them were very concerned about invasive species and what could be done to prevent the spread of invasive species. Others were more concerned about what they could do to try to revegetate the shoreline and improve their water quality. Some had concerns about public accesses, and some were concerned about development issues. So there was just a variety of concerns. And I would go back and forth to various state agencies, talking to them about those concerns, and learn something about this issue through that process, but also learned that sometimes, like associations, wanted the state to step in and address certain things that the state thought the Lake Association or Shoreline members should maybe be handling a little bit different, and not always did that go as smoothly as it might have. So I started to think about what we could do to put these groups together, and certainly there is a lot of interaction between Lake Associations and state agencies already happening. But what I learned was, in some cases it was the DNR, and in other cases it was Soil and Water, in other cases it was the local counties who were having this kind of interaction or providing this assistance. And not always was the information available from just even within my own district, from one Lake Association to the other, in terms of what resources might be out there and might be available to assist them from the state. I also thought that I wanted to try to encourage best management practices with, as Representative Mo said, with a carrot type of approach. This isn't a requirement. So I initially talked to a few people who are on environmental committees. They encouraged me to go ahead with this. And then I had several public meetings. And I was really astonished by the number of people who came. We had a Monday morning meeting in Hackensack, a town of a very small town. And over 100 people showed up. We had way more people than we had chairs for. And they were all very supportive of this concept. I think you have a handout that gives you just a sampling of the kinds of letters and emails that I've received in support of this proposal. And also at the back of that package, there are a couple of newspaper articles, and there have been quite a few more than this, but we just put a couple samples in there. I think the most recent was something that was on Minnesota Public Radio. I have to say that in developing what the criteria should be to be a Star Lake, there was not always consensus. Some people who talked about this thought that we should be more prescriptive in terms of exactly percentages to reach for different levels of say, for example, measuring how much revegetation should happen and how much how far they would go in terms of their goals. Other people felt that we shouldn't be at all prescriptive and should just kind of leave this wide open. The approach that is taken here is kind of a middle of the road. I kept good notes of the comments that were made at these three public meetings I held, and then I sent minutes of the meeting back out to the growing group of people who were interested in this and got feedback back from them. So basically, I tried to put together a consensus here for the committee to look at, and perhaps, you know, whatever you decide to do with add to or subtract from, but that's how it came up with the criteria. The one thing that seemed to be the most important to people, though, was that there would be a management plan, that everyone seemed to agree that was the starting point. And then the criteria that would be in the management plan are set out in the bill. So I don't know how much more, if you want any more detail at this point, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, thank you, Senator Olson. And I think at this point I'll call the meeting officially to order, and if you'd like to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 3437 to pass and to send to,
Government Operations.
Government Operations.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Mo moves that House File 3437 be recommended pass and sent to Government Ops. Representative Wagenius had a question.
Mr. Chairman, one more.
Sure.
Representative Mo. There's also an amendment that Senator Olson has worked on with MnDOT about the signage, and it's a technical amendment. I think it should be passed out.
Okay, it's being passed out. We don't have a copy of the amendment.
We'll have to get a copy. It's not in your packet. We'll get it passed out to you, and then we can move that amendment after.
Okay. Okay. And Representative Wagenius had a question first. Go ahead. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I love the concept of a Star Lake. What I'm kind of taken aback with is the concept of requiring in statute that we establish a nonprofit. Do we have other examples of this in the state?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucinius, yes, we do, and I'm sorry I can't point you to them, but I worked with our Senate counsel in putting this bill together, and this was one format that that he directed me to because there were prior examples of this type of thing being used for similar purposes. So if there's something... I can certainly ask him to get back to me with some references to statutes that would give you that information.
If these are questions for obviously our government operations committee, but we are having this board hire staff. They're not state employees, but get the benefits of state employees. That raises some red flags, and I'm hoping that GovOps also and publishing bylaws in the state register. It's an odd mix of government telling a state, you know, somebody to do a nonprofit, but then becoming a government agency and asking for government appropriations. So I hope as you go through government ops that those kinds of issues are sorted out, because I think the notion of a Star Lake and that kind of program is just dynamite. So you want to make sure it doesn't trip up with things that can trip it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Genius, I'm confident that if you have a concern about that Chair Pulaski will also, and so we'll obviously have that discussion with him and just decide if there are some suggestions he or that committee would also have to streamline that nonprofit or perhaps another mechanism for that committee. And I don't know if this, I can't speak for the senator, but personally I'm not specifically attached to that body actually being the and its current form being the decision-making authority. It needs to be something like that, however, outside, if it's going to be able to accomplish what we want it to.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lugenius. And I would echo Representative Moe's comments. Actually, this was presented to me with two different formats. I'm not wedded to any particular model either. I can only say that the concern that people had when they came to these meetings was that this would be something that would be controlled at the grassroots level, and that they would have some input into the process, and because they are so close to how they're handling their individual lakes and what's working for them and what isn't, they wanted to make sure that it wasn't prescriptive and that they had some say in how the program's administered. But other than that, I'm not wedded to any particular model.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I like the concept that there are tripping points of having something that's grassroots spending state dollars, and that we need to really take care in that, and it might become more of a barrier than something that's opening the doors that you want to open.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Vinny, as you know, this will be going to your committee as well. And I would appreciate if you would, I know we're as soon as we get the bonding bill out here, we'll have a bit more time, but perhaps we can spend some time working on a model that we think might work better. That'd be great.
Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, if you could explain to me, I'll let you do your amendment, and then explain why you needed the language about MnDOT, if they have a permitting process for signs, and if you had to bend their armor to get them to agree to this, because they've been really obstinate with me in two occasions for signs up all over the country, but they wouldn't let me put a little blue sign in the right-of-way, and then other places where I've wanted signs, they've got this screwy formula that so many per feet and this and that, and they got just said, you're not going to get a sign. If you want it up, put it on private property. And So all it was a little Aston Elk resort sign, and so I was wondering how you were able to persuade him.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Corn, if I could understand the process in MnDOT, I think we'd be a lot further along right now than we are. But with that, I'll defer to my senator.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Corn, my game hand.
Actually, this is something that MnDOT brought to me and requested that I amend the bill shortly before this hearing. Before, I think the way the bill was read, that it would be the county who would be doing this, and they just felt that they could have, this is something that they would typically do and that they would prefer to do, not being aware of. So again, I don't have any particular feelings about it one way or another, but perhaps...
I'm Eric Verdeen with MnDOT Government Affairs.
You can explain.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first change the amendment would make would be the way the bill is currently written, cities and counties and other units of government would be the ones erecting the signs. And especially for interstate signs, we feel it's more appropriate to have MnDOT staff erect the signs rather than local government staff or other people working in our right-of-way. So that's the first change. The second just changes the reference to payment of a fee that the fee referenced currently in the bill in 173.13 is for off-premise advertising, which this is really not an advertising sign. So we would reference instead 161.139, which requires that non-highway sources pay for the cost of erecting the sign. And then the last change would be we have different signing standards, and I think this is what Representative Cornish is getting to, where some of our sign standards in the metro area, because of density and the number of signs, we're comfortable putting up signs if a highway actually passes over a river or a lake. In greater Minnesota, we can put signs up if you go near a lake, but in the metro area, just because of the number of signs, we don't typically in the metro area put up signs for bodies of water unless the highway passes directly over that body of water.
Sure.
Representative Cornyn.
I do want to delay Mr. Representative Moe's bill, so I'd love to have a conversation with the afterwards and tell you about my problem.
We'd all love to hear
it. and we do have the amendment before us now as well, so if you'd like to move the amendment, we can, it doesn't have a number on it, but we'll refer to it as the A1 amendment. Everybody would like to put that on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Moe moves the A1 amendment, and this is to put it in the shape and form that the author would like. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And any other questions?
Any other questions specific to communication in particular?
Okay, and if you'd like to make any final comments? Yes. So we take the vote.
Is there I know the Department of Natural Resources had some, would you like to talk about it, Mr. Mayor? Okay.
Yeah.
The DNR has some comments, and if there's anyone else, we'd obviously like to hear it.
Welcome, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you today is great. We really appreciate the interest in working to promote comprehensive lake management and the use of those plans. We just do have some kind of questions or concerns we need to talk about. Is looking at the other planning efforts that are going on right now, local water planning, comprehensive water, county comprehensive plans, watershed plans. There's a question about the coordination and integration with the other plans that are in the bill right now. If you look at subdivision 4, where it says a comprehensive lake or river management plan must contain a self-assessment of the current condition of the lake and rivers, and then it goes on to list things, increases in addressing the following issues, which are great, increases in native vegetation in the littoral area, increases in native vegetation in the shoreline, prevention, reduction, elimination of aquatic invasive species, water pollution sources and methods to reduce pollution, including pollution sources within the watershed or lake or river, identify water impairment issues when feasible, compliance with adopted shoreland zoning ordinances, how the lake association will interact with local government units on large development proposals, zoning and long-range planning issues that affect development on the lake or river. It's just how that self-assessment and those questions will be answered in a detailed manner is something that I think we need to make sure that we're getting the most benefit we can for this and making sure that this designation is actually beneficial. For an organization to have 50% of your members and do a self-assessment that may not be complete and approved by this board, I don't know what the benefits would be. We want to make sure that this is as strong as possible and we're getting the best available benefits that are out there, because it is going to cost some type of money. Revenue for the signs, the publishing in the state register will cost money. Time and effort that will be involved in the board meeting, it's going to be resources, and the resources that people will be looking for to develop these self-assessments are ones that most likely they'll be calling our regional fishery staff, our regional water staff. We need to make sure that people understand that, and as we move forward out of this committee into the finance committee, that we have discussions on what those costs may be. But we do appreciate the goals, and we look forward to working on the bill as we move forward.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Meyer, Representative Virginia.
Thank you. The state used to have a different plan about lakes. Coming out of PCA, where people applied for grants, lakes applied for grants. I can't remember the name of it, and I don't remember, but applied for grants of restoration for things they were going to make, and then they got grants. This was about 5 or 6 years ago, and then we pretty much stopped doing it. And I'm interested in knowing how that would work with this, because that was a good model. I mean, there were benefits to lakes, and then we just stopped supporting our lakes. So that was does staff remember what those were called? Maybe PCA remembers what they're called. But we used to have a program that was similar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, are you referring to the Citizens Water Quality Monitoring Program?
No.
Okay.
It was something different. We had a program that Mr. Holtzman actually worked on and supported, and we pretty much given up on. PCA has given up. The PCA program gave out some money, but it just kind of fizzled out. So I think we need to know something about that program and how.
I think we have somebody.
There you go. It sounds like they know something about
it. Oh. Step four.
And Mr. Chair?
Welcome. Yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I just would also like to say that in addition to the public meeting, we did have a meeting here at the Capitol where I sat down with a gentleman who was just here from the DNR, someone from PCA, someone from Soil and Water, and some of what's in the bill was based on their suggestions. That we not, again, it says that the department may consider a Star Lake designation, but it doesn't tie their hands in a way that they were uncomfortable with by saying they must do this or they must do that.
Okay. And thank you for joining us. If you could state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And Representative Wiginius, I believe that the program that you're speaking about, maybe the Clean Water Partnership Program, if that rings a bell, okay, great. And that program does still exist, and there are still resources that go towards that program. What's happened over the last few years is a lot of times the projects that get funded through that tend to be focused on restoration projects rather than on protection projects, which I think the Star Lake proposal is intended to kind of look more towards that protection arena. One thing I did want to mention to the committee is that the Pollution Control Agency does understand the concern about the need for funding and resources for protection efforts. We are looking at what possibilities might be there for directing some of the Clean Water Partnership funding towards those protection efforts in particular. We're still doing that evaluation, so we're kind of in that process of looking at that as a potential opportunity.
Thank you. And Representative Hackforth, did you have a question? No.
Taking care of things.
Okay. Any further questions? Yeah, again, I appreciate the approach that you're taking here on this issue as well. I think that the carrot approach oftentimes does work better with better results than the stick approach, and so I appreciate that. And also the fact that you're working on trying to get a consensus with the various groups involved here. Do you have any final comments before we take the vote?
Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, I know you have other bills here. I think, and we've heard a little bit already, that there are some tools at our disposal within the other agencies. In particular, the DNR is doing a lot of these things already, however, but not in, perhaps in as specifically as coordinated a fashion as would happen if we had a Star Lake proposal where there was a concerted group of citizens actually trying to use the tools from the state agencies and leverage that with their own muscle and dollars. So again, I think this is a way for us to stretch those tax dollars, allowing people to take care of their own bodies of water as opposed to relying on us to do all the work.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess one final comment I would make is that considering the funding challenges that we have this year, what this allows for is, you know, the Star Lake designation, I believe, is, from all the input that I've heard back, is a reward in itself. However, and the only funding we'd be asking for is something very minimal to pay for what I would envision as one administrative staff just to review these applications and process paperwork. But there's a framework there for, as has been said, the possibility there may be additional funds available for organizations that are really putting a lot of their own time and volunteer resources in so that we can maximize the benefit of any resources we might have available in the future. Certainly I'd be happy if they were made available now, but you know, I know what the realities are. But I've also had letters from initiative foundations who are looking at this proposal with a lot of interest and considering the possibility that they might make money available that could be looked at by this board and where there would be applications for specific needs that lakes might have. And so I think that was the reason for the way this has been designed, and maybe it needs some work. But the hope was that there would be an opportunity for both private and public donations to something if it seems to be working well.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no further discussion or testimony, Representative Moe renews this motion that House File 3437, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed and referred to Government Ops. Thank you. Moving on to Representative Anzell. House File 2737. Welcome, Representative Anzels, and I will move House File 2737.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2737 is about the Wetland Conservation Act, wetlands as they pertain to the 16 counties in northern Minnesota, which are designated as 80% wetland counties. This legislation the amendment that's being passed out now is a delete all amendment.
And maybe we should, at this point, move the delete all amendment as well. And again, it's not, there was one in the packet. That's not the one that we're using. It's the one that's being passed out. And so I will move the A081187 amendment. And this is to put it in the shape and form that the author would like. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Anzell, to the bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Members, I've worked over the interim with the Arrowhead Counties Association and with Bowser to craft some language that makes the Wetland Conservation Act work a little bit better for local units of government in the 16 counties of northern Minnesota. And that's what this attempt, that's what this language attempts to do. Both Mr. Jasky and the Arrowhead Counties Association, St. Louis County Commissioner Dennis Sink are here to help out with any questions you have, but basically this proposes that wetland bank credit that Bowser will make subject to rules adopted by Bowser to allow wetland credits to be purchased by these 16 counties in a more manageable and cost-effective way. I think it would be appropriate if I could have Mr. Jasky explain a little bit more technically of how this would work.
Welcome, Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, John Jasky, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources. As described, this language, as amended, there's really two important words in here, actually three. The first one, Representative Angel's already noted, which is that it only applies to those counties in northeastern Minnesota that have the great abundance of wetlands. The second key word there is in the first line regarding preservation. And in the last year and a half or so, we've been working with the Army Corps of Engineers as well as through our state rulemaking authority to develop standards and options for getting some credit, wetland mitigation credit, for when wetlands are at risk are preserved so that people aren't forced to remove them and then put them back and then get credit for them. And so it's very, you know, strategic approach to giving some credit for preservation because, of course, we have to meet the known at loss criteria. But we believe that this language would be workable and we would accomplish it and already have embarked on it in our rulemaking process, which is underway as we speak. So we've worked out a similar agreement with the Corps of Engineers, and I think we can accommodate this in a helpful way into our rulemaking effort right now.
Okay. Thank you, Director Jasky. Are there any questions for the Director or Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Van Zels and Mr. Jasky. Last year in the finance bill, we authorized a mitigation study and provided funding for that, and I know that was supposed to start kind of look at these issues. Can you maybe explain what the status of that is and what this bill does relating to that study?
Chairman, Representative Hansen, that's a good point. Last year there was money appropriated to do what we called a Northeast Wetland Mitigation Assessment, and that was to look for the opportunities, and there aren't very many that are really clear in northeastern Minnesota to do wetland mitigation, recognizing that we're going to have wetland impacts from road building, from some of the mining expansion and other commercial enterprises, as well as, you know, the usual home development and so forth. And the idea was to look comprehensively at those opportunities rather than trying to find them one by one when a project was being considered. And so that endeavor is about to be begun with a contract that we will be signing to get the work started. And that information will guide this implementation of this new language if adopted, and also will guide our rulemaking effort to identify where exactly these opportunities are. So the two are very much connected.
Any other? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, and I apologize for walking in late, Representative Anzo. So essentially what this would do is allow that wetlands already protected under a state conservation easement, maybe they're under DNR land or only DNR land, not local government.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I'm looking at now the amendment, of course, the 1187 amendment. The one key word that's in that amendment is the word subsequently, because the current standards, and we would retain that, is that you only can get credit, you know, when the rules say you can, and then to accomplish that, you have to have a state conservation easement on that land subsequent to that approval. So lands that are currently under a conservation easement of any sort would not be eligible, but those that would be enrolled after the fact, if they met the rule test, would be.
Okay.
given some credit. So I should point out that this is a fairly different approach than what the original bill had proposed.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jaffe. And we also have two other people listed to testify. Mr. John Angero. From St. Louis County. Welcome, Mr. Angero, and if you could state your name and position, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Angero, Director of Government Relations for the Arrowhead Counties Association. I'm just here today to simply amplify what Representative Anzels has already stated and to make clear to the committee that the Arrowhead Counties Association strongly supports this legislation and would appreciate your approval of it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Angero. Any questions for Mr. Angero? Okay. Seeing none, thanks again. And next we have Mr. Dennis Fink, St. Louis County Commissioner. Welcome, Mr. Fink, and again, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm St. Louis County Commissioner Dennis Fink. We want to thank you for looking at this bill as well. This bill will, in fact, enhance some of the things that occurred last year. The study that is being looked at this particular moment will take some time to get completed. There's a number of things that we know that will happen in our area that will include conservation easements over the next couple of years, and we want to make sure that they at least get some looking at, and this bill will help us do that as well.
Okay.
And I'm here basically to answer questions as Mr. Angero suggested.
Right. Any questions for Mr. Fink or Representative Anzel? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fink, just on the for the banking credits, is this, I mean, are there anticipated projects? I know Representative Anzel's had an issue with a hospital. I mean, is that the type of project you're looking at, kind of public entities, or is it public and private wetland mitigation?
We're actually looking at both. But significantly from our point, we know that there will be some conservation easements that are being looked at, particularly through several other bills and several other programs for which the state operates. And we think that it's important for us to understand that when preservation occurs, that is one side of the equation, and development on the other side of the equation is where those credits may very well be used.
Representative Hansen.
I'm sympathetic to Representative Anzels on the hospital. I'm a little concerned if this, I mean, we spent about, before session started, a lot of time relating to mining questions, and I'm just wondering if this is related to that or if this is road building projects and more public focus.
Representative Anzels.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, thank you for asking about that, frankly. This legislation is not tailored or earmarked or directed toward any one specific activity or project. It's designed to help us make it possible to grow some jobs and do some economic development in these particular counties. With regard to the hospital, this is a proposed project in the community of International Falls in Kuchikin County, and the struggles are huge. And to add the wetland issue to those struggles is very, very frustrating, and this legislation would, in the long haul, begin to address some of those concerns.
And Mr. Fink.
And I appreciate you asking about the mining as well. As you know, we are putting in a new steel plant in the Itasca and St. Louis County.
In my district.
Yeah, that's true as well. But we are moving in that direction, and one of the issues that brought this to light was the fact that there was a great deal of wetlands that needed to be mitigated, and within that, finding that the mitigation process was extremely difficult. It came to St. Louis County Board's attention as we were dealing with this, and we have looked at, we've noticed other projects for economic development that also has created some extreme issues for us, and finding the credits that was necessary and being able to reestablish wetlands in an area which is already 93.6% retains 93.6% of the wetlands that current that pre-settlement makes it very difficult for us to balance the, both economic development and the credits that are necessary to achieve these economic development.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then what you're saying is if a mine comes in and they need to have a wetland for some purpose related to the mine, then you would designate one of these wetlands to be credited, and how does that credit work? I guess I'm not sure myself.
Director Jaffe. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi. You know, it's going to be very site-specific, number one, so I can't give you probably a real good general answer, but what this language would do would be to allow a wetland that exists currently but is at risk because someone has a right to do something to it, you know, fill it, drain it, remove all the vegetation, whatever it might be. So it's at risk. And then some credit could be accrued for them agreeing to preserve it as is in its current, you know, good state, let's put it that way, via a conservation easement. So there has to be a threat in order to be able to get credit for preservation. The normal way you get credit is to go restore or create a wetland somewhere where one isn't, or where it's already been degraded by drainage or fill, typically. So this is a fairly narrow provision, but in certain cases it can be very helpful.
Representative Virginia.
Are all these state conservation easements permanent?
Chairman, Representative Williams, yes, they are.
I was wondering as far as the magnitude of the problem that you faced up there because of the 80% wetlands. Is this something that would resolve the issue and solve the problems, or as I understand it, this is going to be within the watershed areas that that those wetlands are located in? I know there's been suggestions about looking outside of those watershed areas to find wetlands that would mitigate for these purposes. Is that still something that would be necessary to address, again, the magnitude of the problem that you're facing as far as the loss of wetlands because of development?
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, that's what Representative Hansen noted, that this project or this assessment inventory is going to tell us kind of what the scope and scale of the opportunities for mitigation are there. And then also, if there aren't opportunities, what the next best options are and how far afield you might go to do the mitigation. What this would do, again, would be, it won't solve any problems. It just may provide an opportunity in a few cases to allow for some credit that would be closer to the impact than may otherwise be.
And Commissioner Frank.
The issue is exactly the question that you give today. We are, in many cases, having to look outside of our own region, outside of our own watershed, which is obviously not what the Wetlands Conservation Act suggests, in order to obtain the credits just to move small projects. Mm-hmm. And this would help us look within our own area to have as many as we could possibly achieve.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Oh, Representative Virginia.
Thank you. I don't understand, in a practical sense, the difference between preservation and wetlands you're talking about and a wetland that is a peat bog. You know, it contains peat. And we have carbon problems when we're taking peat away. Help me understand if there's any that I could be thinking about here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, there's a lot of things to think about on that topic, but certainly the peat mining, as you know, is regulated under a permit to mine if it exceeds a certain threshold. I think it's 40 acres. Someone from DNR can probably correct me if I'm wrong about that. again, this legislation, as proposed, would only give credit if there was a demonstrable threat or they otherwise could exercise a right they already had. It does give no rights to do any additional impact to women. It simply says if you have an already existing right to do something to women and you don't exercise it, you could get some credit for that. So, your example, actually, maybe, you know, that someone had an authorization to do a mining project in a wetland that would remove peat, if they chose to not exercise that option and to permanently protect that area, they could potentially get some wetland replacement credit for that.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If this helps fix the problem, then we have almost $1 billion shortfall, and we have a study that hasn't started yet, and we're going to have to look at cuts. Is it still necessary to do the study?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Manson, you know, the study will tell us where we can do this. If we just have the concept, we're still going to be looking all over northeastern Minnesota for exactly where these opportunities are. So it's important to know where they are precisely before we can know how to implement this.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Anybody else that wants to testify? Okay, with that, Representative Anzel, any final
words? Chairman and members, thank you so much for your time and your great questions. This is a work in progress. I realize it's complex and we'll be working with you as the process develops.
Thank you, Representative Anzel. And I will renew the motion that House File 2737, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor? We have a question, Representative Peckforth.
Where are we referring to?
It's going to the floor, as I understand it. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So, again, any other questions? So we need a motion that it be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Representative Gardner? Representative Gardner.
Sorry, I'm late. We had a little bipartisan carbon emission reduction initiative going on, carpooling to another meeting, and the weather deteriorated, and we just got back. Mr. Chair, I do have a delete all amendment, and I'd like to move that the H3238 DE1 amendment to. Or should I move the bill originally first to do that?
Yes,
I'd like to move House File 3238 and recommend it pass and go to local government and metropolitan affairs.
So Representative Gardner moves House File 3238 to be recommended to pass and referred to local government and to be move the amendment next.
Great. I'd like to move the H3238 DE1 amendment.
Okay. Representative Gardner moves the DE1 amendment to get it in shape and form. And he would like all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Gardner, to the bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my role as chair of the Subcommittee on Drinking Water Source Protection, I've learned a lot about what we know and what we don't know about our water resources in the state of drinking water, and groundwater in particular. Our groundwater is not as sustainable a resource as we might think when you look at information about confined aquifers, where there's some sort of geological layer or clay above a certain aquifer that's been left there many thousands of years ago. Rainwater doesn't actually get down there to recharge them very well. And in environmental finance and in the drinking water subcommittee and trying to find out just how sustainable resources are, we find that there aren't a lot of easy answers. And since water is one of our greatest resources in the state, and since some of that data is still lacking on a comprehensive basis, I am proposing a modest effort to focus on municipal water suppliers and how they promote conservation. And there's also issues here with the PCA having an ombudsman on water quality, which I'll get to in a second. I did take out several sections which either were problematic or not very tight, and I just wanted to talk about a couple of these items, if I may, Mr. Chair, perhaps to give some comfort to those who had questions. In Section 3 in particular, Section 3 would be requiring public water suppliers to have a conservation rate structure in place, and that does not necessarily imply a price that would necessarily cost more under certain circumstances. There are some commercial water users, some of whom I've just talked to in the last 10 minutes, you know, who are concerned, and they are consistent water users. And what we're really looking for is a variety of tools in the toolbox, if you will, that you can use to, I know you like that cliche, Mr. Chair, municipalities can use to make sure that we're not simply wasting valuable groundwater resources. But there are commercial users that are consistent users, or they are not peak users in the way that you and I might water our lawn twice a day, every day, and you're having to drill new wells to just meet that need. So it does not prescribe what kind of method a municipality, a municipal water supplier would use to encourage conservation, so there's a lot of flexibility there. Section 4 includes a drinking water emergency management plan. I am in discussions with the DNR late yesterday about making sure that this doesn't duplicate some work that's already being done at the city level, and we will have that worked out by the time we get to local government, which is where the people are really going to be concerned about that section. But I think what I'm really trying to do is making sure cities, if some disaster or bacterial infection or what happened takes place, that people have a resource they can pull off the shelf and say, all right, we need to call this number and we need to do this plan and here's where we need to allocate our resources. In Section 5, the groundwater information standard, everybody loves this section. I had people come in the office and it was a recommendation of the health department to get all units of government with the same data standard for how to share groundwater information, and it seems to be long overdue. In Section 6 and 7 have to do with contaminated groundwater. Section 6, this actually follows from a situation we've had in my district in the city of North Oaks, where several houses have been contaminated by vinyl chloride, and literally in the last few years, several people have bought homes that had vinyl chloride in them, and the seller knew that they were contaminated wells or were being monitored by the Department of Health, and that was not disclosed, and the new owner said, oh, gosh, gee, thanks, now I've got this contaminated well to deal with. So we're asking for that to be disclosed. Section 7 promotes an ombudsman for groundwater pollution education and assistance. I had this in a separate bill last year, and because we didn't really have a lot of time to look through it, I asked that it be tabled. But I've just discovered in talking with people in communities where they have faced contamination, particularly their municipal water supply, that they don't really know what their options are. They don't know what the laws are related to water regulation. They don't know really where to go. And I actually did bring this concept up to the commissioner of the PCA, just suggesting that we could cut through a lot of the time and effort that citizens and local governments and state agencies have to deal with citizen requests and citizen concerns if we had someone within the agency who is the go-to person for people from the public to go to find out where to go, to cut through the red tape, to cut through the maze of bureaucracy they have to go to, not just at the state level, but the local and federal level. There would need to be an appropriation if that would go through, and Representative Lagunas did request this for environmental finance in its previous version anyway, and I'm assuming she'd like to see it again, so I was planning to address that issue at that time. Section 8 was a request of the Met Council, which is extending the deadline for the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Committee by 2 years. They're doing a lot of really great activities to make sure that all our water supply planning in the Twin Cities metro area is happening. There's a lot of municipalities, about 100 cities, 7 counties, state agencies and the like, and we really need to make sure that we have a safe and plentiful water supply in the future, but they still have some work to do, and so they've asked for an extension. And Mr. Chair, that's it.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. There are testifiers. We do have Mr. Craig Johnson first from the League of Minnesota Cities. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And I'm also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Water Works Association this afternoon. And want to particularly thank Representative Gardner for the work he's put into this bill. Our city water works folks spend a tremendous amount of time trying to figure out how we can encourage conservation while still having an effective water utility that can cover its costs and supply water for industries and residential units on a typically growing basis as communities develop. And we feel that this is a good start toward helping us do that. We don't feel it conflicts with our needs to have some flexibility. In fact, it recognizes that pretty explicitly and allows us to look in different communities at different ways that it might need to be approached while still moving forward on water conservation. In particular, the drinking water management plans is something communities are already working on. We will be working with the Department of Natural Resources and the author to make sure the wording in that section doesn't conflict with any of our existing planning requirements and, in fact, either helps them or adds some additional information that might be helpful to them if needed. And in particular, support Section 5, which will put groundwater information in the same format between jurisdictions, make it much easier to compare apples to apples as we're looking at water information. We also do support extending the Met Council water study to make sure that there's adequate time to continue looking at the issues they're looking at. So, that, Mr. Chair, be happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Okay. If you have any questions for Mr. Johnson, or Representative Gardner. Seeing none, thanks again, and we have Mr. Jim Jack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Japp, Assistant Director of DNR Division of Waters. Representative Gardner and Craig Johnson just addressed the issue I was going to speak to, and that's really the coordination of the emergency plan components of this and how that fits in with the water supply plans that are required by Minnesota Statutes 103G291, and we'll be working on that together to sort that out and make sure there's no redundancy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Japp. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, we have also Mr. Jamboy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with on the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. It's 86 cities in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and we too want to thank Representative Gardner for bringing this bill forward. As the other testifiers have mentioned, we believe there are some areas in the bill that perhaps need to be tightened up. We don't think there's any inherent conflict, but there's not necessarily obvious compatibility with a couple of other provisions in statute, principally 473.1565. That's the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Planning Activities and Advisory Committee. That statute provides roles and responsibilities for the Metropolitan Council or to the Metropolitan Council, which may or may not, depending on who reads these two things side by side may be compatible or in conflict. We know that all of the state agencies are working with the Met Council on water supply planning in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and generally they agree, but in those areas where they don't agree, they will go back to their own statutes and identify the roles and responsibilities that exist there. And if we have conflicting roles and responsibilities in more than one statute, people tend to dig in their heels and not move. There are a lot of cooks in the water permitting and appropriation kitchen. The role that we hope that all the agencies take is to make that easier for people to navigate through, that it's easier to get through the water appropriation and permitting process when there's conflict in the state agencies. It's our cities that tend to get sort of stuck in the middle. So we want to work with Representative Gardner as he proceeds forward. We think we can perhaps add some value to the bill and keep the state agencies and the Met Council working together.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Jamboy? Okay. Thank you. No other testifiers?
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Gardner?
I was going to mention that I did meet in the hallway today with someone from the Multi Housing Association who indicated that we may need to tweak this a little bit to take into account that there are housing units with, you know, four plus units where, you know, the metering situation is a little different. They may have some language coming forward too, but they didn't have anything at this point.
Okay.
But that was it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Any other questions? Oh, yes. Welcome.
This is smoother than the first bill here I've had. I'm scratching my head.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just received a copy of the amendment, and I'm Christine Berger with the Minnesota Association.
And if I could just ask you to identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Christine Berger with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Just took a look at Section 6 on page 3 and 4, and I believe the realtors would probably have some problem with that section, but I'd be so happy to work with the author of the bill and try to figure out a way, you know, to find a compromise, and if we can work on that before the next stop, that would be phenomenal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else? Any other questions or testifiers? Representative Gardner, any final statements?
No, Mr. Chair, I know you've got a tight schedule, but I'm certainly interested in hearing from other stakeholders to see how we can make this work if we need to make changes. So, may I renew my motion then, Mr. Chair, to move House File 3238 as amended, recommended to pass, and go to local government and metropolitan affairs. Okay.
Representative Gardner renews his motion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion prevails. Bill is passed. No, okay, the next bill that we have on the agenda. House File 3068, Representative Dill. If you'd like to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to bring House File 3068 before it's recommended to pass or referred to the General Register.
Okay. That needs to be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
So oh, is that where it's going?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't want it to go there, but that's where it's got to go. Got to go. All right, thank you. And I have a if the we could pass out that one page amendment, as you see.
I'll explain the bill when we get the amendment out. I'll ask that we take that under consideration. It's more of a clarification amendment anyway. The purpose of the bill, the first item, if you look on line 1.8, is to extend the temporary registrations on snowmobiles and ATVs and boats to include up to 21 days. This would mirror the registration of an automobile. Presently, they're 10 days. So the problem with 10 days is that a dealer sells a new item, new boat, new snowmobile, new ATV, then he has to go down to the registrar at some point, get the pay the fees that the person paid them for the registration, then go back to his dealership, put them in the mail, and mail them to that person. During that hearing period, they get a temporary that's good for 10 days. I've learned from dealers that they usually do that once a week. So it makes it very tight time frame to have a 10-day window. So what happens in practicality, someone is out there riding their ATV, driving their boat, riding their snowmobile, and they run out of time because the dealer hasn't gotten back to them the completed packet of registration with the stickers, etc. So what we're doing is just extending it out, and then it will be the same as automobiles, and all of those uses would be the same. The next item in the bill is in regard to when the dealer sells, and this is regarding snowmobiles, when the dealer sells a new sled, and he sells the customary registration, the customer can buy a trail sticker. If you recall the trail sticker we passed a couple of years ago, and he can sell that for all 3 years of the registration for $10 a year. If the customer doesn't buy the registration at the trail sticker at the time of registration, then he has to buy it for 1 year at a time at a cost of $15 per year. So it just makes sense that people pay the 3 years at the time of registration at the time of the purchase for $30. The problem is that there's nowhere on the temporary certificate of registration that the dealer gives the individual that shows that he paid for a trail sticker. So, he has a registration now on the snowmobile, because he has the temporary. Now it's only good for 10 days, so he changed it. So he goes out on the trail and he runs into a conservation officer. And the conservation officer says, I need to see your registration and trail sticker. And he says, well, I have my car. So he hands him the paperwork and he says, well, this doesn't say that you bought a trail sticker. I'm going to give you a ticket because you don't have a trail sticker. And he says, well, I paid for the trail sticker. And he says, well, there's nowhere on here that shows that you paid for a trail sticker. So what this does is it requires that the dealer, or that the registration form, have a place on the registration that allows the dealer to indicate that that was paid for. It has the dealer's name and number, so that if there's any question, the conservation officer can call. Now you say, boy, that sounds like a lot of work for nothing. But the truth is that we've got at least one conservation officer that just preys on these kinds of opportunity to give people tickets. This happened this winter a fair amount. The other problem with the trail stickers is as the system has grown, and the next provision in the bill is as the system has grown and we've gotten registrations and we've gotten this and we've gotten that, they all seem to expire at different times. As an example, the trail sticker that I just referenced expires on April 1st. The dealer registration that is transferable from snowmobile to snowmobile, it's on a little plate, that expires on December 31st. And your registration sticker, which looks like the little state of Minnesota that you put on the snowmobile, that expires on June 30th. So, we have a conservation officer out trying to do his job, and he stops the snowmobiler at Christmas time. And he says, you got a current registration, but you don't have a current trail sticker. And the guy says, wait a minute, this is 2007, my sticker says it's 07. He goes, well, I know, but that expired last April of 07.
So he got a $144 ticket for not having a trail sticker. So what this does, folks, is this, it makes everything expire at the same time. The dealer plate expires, the trail sticker expires, and the registration expires, all on the same day. Then there really wouldn't be any reason not to know that one is expired and one isn't. So since you're not snowmobiling from April 1st until the following, usually December or November at the very earliest, it really doesn't have any impact except it makes it more easily followed by the consumer. Since the dealer plate now expires in June on December 31st, they're really kind of getting hit the first year because they pay for their dealer plate in July. It's good till December 31st. This is going to cut, you know, this is going to advance it for 1 year, what they paid, and then it'll all be on schedule. So that's essentially what the bill does, and it does the same thing for in terms of the temporary registration for snowmobiles and or for ATVs and boats. So then there, I have an amendment haphazardly drafted that adds on. It is a clarification amendment. I'll read it to you. You have it there before you, and it says page 4 of the bill, line 24. Add item C, that a temporary registration permit issued by the dealer under this section may include a trail sticker if the trail sticker is included in the registration fee. That's a clarification that they thought was necessary. I don't know if Mr. Cadelka wants to explain why we have to have that in there. But.
Okay, well, yeah, would Ms. Watts want to explain?
Oh, Ms. Watts, are you here?
Yes, Representative Mull.
That's why the block's coming down. Representative, would you just explain something? Yeah, I mean, I completely put the bill. I understand the problem. I've heard it before, too. If so, okay, say if I, you know, I might have a double snowmobile trailer and buy another snowmobile, you know, at a different time, 6 months later, how will that system work then again? So, is it the stickers specific to that snowmobile?
Right. In the case of the trail sticker, the normal use of the sticker is affixed on the snowmobile and it can't be removed.
Right.
So once you put it on, it's for that sled.
Right.
Now, in the case of a dealer plate, they allow for the trail sticker to be on the dealer plate, which they can go from sled to sled to sled to sled because it's for demonstration purposes. Oh, did that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So this is kind of a technical. This is not establishing any new plates or stickers or anything like that, Mr. Chairman. This is technical, the whole bill.
Okay. Representative Cornish has a question.
Representative Dill, I support your bill, too, and I think the DNR doesn't have a problem. I just have a problem with the word preying upon the citizens. I mean, there are actually officers. There are actually officers that write exactly 8 to 9 times as many tickets as this officer that you're having a problem with up there. So he is doing his job quite efficiently, but just, if we could leave the color out of it, I'd appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you hear Mr. Potter in the audience laughing quite loudly, and he knows what I'm talking about. And you're right. He's doing his job very, very, very efficiently.
Mr. Chairman, I have some
questions.
To remember a certain CEO used to prey upon them.
Yeah.
I think you're not mailing phrase P-R-A-Y.
Mr. Chair, we have Ms. Watts here. She'll explain the reason for the amendment.
Ms. Watts? If you could identify
Chairman,
yourself.
Members of the City Hall. My name is Pat Watts. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources Enforcement Division. And that amendment was just to provide a clarification in the trail sticker language to make sure that we're clear that the trail sticker can be included on the temporary registration that's provided by the dealership. Just to make sure that there's a cross between the registration section in 8482 and the trail sticker section in 8482.05.
Any questions for Ms. Watts?
So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll renew my motion to send this to government, recommend a pass and to government operations.
Representative Dill, we didn't have the amendment moved yet, so we could do that, and we could just refer to that again as the A1
yep.
amendment. So
So Representative Dill moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
I'll renew my
amendment is adopted.
And,
Representative Dill moves House File 3068 as amended, be recommended pass, and referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
How come I looked at the other party first and then I looked at my own party?
Okay, and Representative Bill has another bill before us. House File 3281.
So I'd like to bring with a motion the bill before us, and what is the recommendation on this, the Chairman?
To refer to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice.
All right.
So Representative Dill moves House File 3281, the recommended pass, and refer to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Dill.
Thank you. So again, members, we have an A1 amendment. And the amendment needs to, as I see it, become a delete-all amendment because we are going to return the original language. If you look on line 1.17, we're going to leave the language the same. Can you explain this, Mr. Kudelka, how we're going to frame this up, or Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair and members, to the A1 amendment, we could just make it into a delete-everything amendment. We can delete section 1. We don't need section 1 of the bill anymore, so we could just modify that.
Well, I would move the A1 amendment, and that will get the bill in the shape that I need it.
Okay. Representative Dill moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what this does, members, is allow the person, some years ago in snowmobile accidents, I think Representative Peterson, which would be Aaron Peterson's dad, put into law the part about this law about 1976. If your birthday is after December 31, 1976, you must have a safety certificate to operate a snowmobile. And that's fine. I mean, we had no quarrel with that. A good thing. We certainly promote snowmobiling. But what happens is, as we get farther away from 1976, we find that out on the trail system there are people that are 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, and now 31. They're out there riding, and sometimes they won't have a safety certificate. Didn't know they had to have a safety certificate. They came into the sport, decided they got the money, they bought a snowmobile, and they started riding it. And so then this very efficient conservation officer, he decides that when he checks their sled, that he better check their safety certificate, so he does. And they don't have it, and so they get a very expensive ticket because they didn't have it. And so what this bill does, members, is this really gets people that have, whether they did it on purpose or whether they did it accidentally, this promotes them getting a safety certificate, and it does so by doing this. That it says that a person that does not have a safety certificate that should have a safety certificate, if they get a ticket, that when a prescribed number of days, they must either pay the ticket or take the safety course, and when they produce their certificate that they've taken the safety course, then the ticket will be voided. And so that's all it does, is it encourages people to get their safety certificate if they're found not to have it. And one other thing, I'd like to make an oral amendment now then to the delete all. On line 1.5 it says 14 days, and on 1.7 it says 14 days. And I'm talking to Mr. Meyer, Deputy Commissioner, or Assistant Commissioner. He says that they have to mail out a CD to the person. Any person that requests the safety system or the safety program, they have to mail out a CD. So I need to increase that time a bit, because if you get a ticket and then you get home and you forget about it a day or two, and then you call in and they take the week to mail it to them, and then takes another few days to get it taken, another week, and then a week to get it to the conservation officer, I think the 30 days would be more reasonable. When I first wrote the 14 days, I thought that this was totally online, but apparently you have to have a CD to make the computer work to be online to make it work. So my amendment, Mr. Chair, is to change on 1.15 the 14 to 30 and the same amendment on line 1.7, and I'd like to move that to oral amendment.
Okay, Representative Dill moves that on lines 1.5 and 1.7, 14 be changed to 30.
And that's the discussion. The bill, and I'm ready for questions.
Okay. Any discussion? Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I perhaps wasn't listening carefully enough, but Representative Dill referred to this as the delete all amendment. Is this the delete all amendment?
The delete all amendment has already been passed, and now we are amending the delete all.
I'm up to slow through. Mr. Chair, this, we're on 3281, right?
Right, and it wasn't drafted as a delete all, but we did orally change it to a delete all amendment.
Okay, close attention. Thank you. Just wanted to be sure.
Sure.
And then obviously the oral amendment on top of the amendment.
Right. Any discussion on the oral amendment? Seeing none. Representative Scalzi.
I just had one question, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dill. Then, and maybe from the DNR's perspective, is this a great cost for you to mail out the CD and resend the ticket, or how is that going to work, and how would you pay for that process?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, again for the record, Bob Meyer, DNR. The costs aren't that great. I mean, the benefits of making sure people do the training and see the CD are well worth any cost that we have out there. Snowmobile safety, any of our riding safety, is a number one priority for us. And if you are interested in seeing this training CD, please let me know. I'll get you copies, because the first 5 or 7 minutes of it is a story that was on Care 11 News about a person involved in a snowmobile accident. I think after somebody sees that, the way that they handle their machine is a lot different. So our number one priority is making sure people are trained and do get that CD in their possession. So the costs are covered throughout the program.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer and Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Meyer, if someone requested the CD right now without this change, you would send it to them, correct?
Mr. Chair, members, yes.
Mr. Meyer.
We call our information center, our safety education training center.
Okay. And Representative Wiginius, you had a question?
No,
I
think my question
is
answered.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, Representative Dill renews his motion. So Representative Dill renews his motion for the oral amendment. Any other discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Cornyn.
Representative Dill, one thing I'd be interested in working with you and Representative Wagenius on is we talked about it a number of years ago. One of two things you could do to make this a lot easier in the future is, I'll support your bill today, but either enter this somehow into the ELS system, or and when we meet somebody out there with a hunting or fishing license that they don't have in their possession, now we just get a cell phone out and dial into the vendor and we can find out right away. Either that or card readers. Right now we got firearm safety certificate and the thing entered on our driver's license. And you enter this on your driver's license, and you get a card reader that officers carry in other states. We don't have them. But you take your driver's license, the warden doesn't slide it right through, and then it reads out everything that they've got. And so that would prohibit all of this fancy footwork that we're doing. But what you think about that in the future, working on it? We sure can't do it this year because there's no money. But
Representative,
I'd certainly like to make the conservation officers work more efficient as I'm spending my time here in the legislature. So I go with that idea.
So, are there any other questions to the author?
I renew my motion to pass the House file as amended.
Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 3281 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Bill is passed. And Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I'd like to, don't know where you're sending this bill, but I'd like to make a motion to bring it before House File 3284.
Okay, and that's also referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
Public Safety.
Civil Justice.
Okay. So to the bill, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to read you the bill. It's very short. It's just basically one sentence. It says, a state employee shall not enforce federal laws in the navigable waters within Voyageurs National Park. And then it goes on to cite the stat, 84B06061. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to read you that out of the, read you that statute out of the book here. It says, in making these donations, meaning the state lands to the park, none of the navigable waters within the park and the lands under them have been donated to the United States. The navigable waters include the following: Rainy, Kabatogama, Namekan, Sandpoint, and Crane Lake. Pursuant to applicable federal laws and state laws, navigable waters and their beds are owned by the state. Ownership and jurisdiction over these waters and their beds have not been ceded by the state. In other words, passed to someone else. In the discharge of their official duties, the governor, attorney general, and other constitutional officers and other public officials, such as the Commissioner of Natural Resources, shall vigorously assert and defend in all forums the state's ownership and jurisdiction over the waters and their beds and related natural resources, together with associated rights of the state and its citizens arriving from the state's ownership and jurisdictions of the waters. In discharging these duties, the same time officers, the governor, attorney general, and constitutional officers, and public officials shall additionally be especially cognizant of the free rights of travel afforded to the citizens of Minnesota and others. Okay? If you open up your map, members, that I provided you, you'll see, if it's more on this side, you'll see the four major lakes that this law, 84061, refers to. Rainy Lake, Kabatogama, Namekan, Sandpoint, and Crane Lake. And you'll also notice on that map that there's a snowmobile trail, a grant and aid snowmobile trail that is also in law under the grant and aid section. Mr. Potter could tell us it's not important what section that's under at the moment. That was established by this legislature. The speed limit on those lakes, according to state law, is 65 miles an hour. But the National Park Service has come along and decided that they have jurisdiction over the waters, when it expressly says in state law that we have never ceded that jurisdiction in the creation of the park, and that we as public officials must defend it. And they have said the speed limit is 45. So what we have is, we have a speed limit established by someone who has, in my estimation, and according to state law, no authority. And then we have state officials that go out and enforce the 45 rather than the state speed limit. Now, if you look at Kabatogama Lake, which is in the center of the map to the top, along this south shoreline, as an example, there are dozens of resorts, and their resort property runs right up to the edge of the water. And people take ATVs off of their shore out onto the water to go out and go fishing. The Park Service has decided that ATV use on the lakes is illegal. And so fishermen can't go out with ATVs because they get tickets from the federal government for operating an ATV on the lake, even though trucks and four-wheel drive SUVs are allowed on the lake. And state employees, from time to time, do the same thing. On this entire area, which, according to state law, belongs to the state, the navigable waters of these lakes, the Park Service has decided that no one can operate any kind of commercial aircraft off of those lakes, such as a float plane. So a resort that has someone fly into the International Falls Airport and would like to have their guests delivered down to the resort on the lake can't land on state waters because the park decided that they've taken jurisdiction of the state waters. They allow private float planes to land on those state waters, the park does, even though they don't have jurisdiction, but they've outlawed commercial aircraft. So there's just this long string of things that have occurred since 1975 that the park has usurped the state's authority that's in law, and from time to time, state officials enforce the federal provisions. And all this bill says is that a state employee, meaning our very efficient conservation officer, is not able to enforce the federal provisions. This has nothing to do with how fast, this has nothing to do with boat safety, boat cushions, state laws, state fishing limits. All the state laws are still enforceable. Everything is enforceable. This refers to federal law. Federal laws, in my estimation, and in accordance to this state statutes that have been imposed on waters that we have not ceded the jurisdiction of the water or the bed that they lie on. That is the bill.
Representative Wagenius has a question.
Thank you. Representative Shill, I hear your problem as a relatively narrow one. Mm-hmm. And ask if you have talked to Congressman Oberstar about this.
Oh, yes.
He's a big deal.
Okay. And
we're not, he doesn't control the state government.
No, I understand, but you have you've got a federal government problem that you're giving to us, and then talking, and so it's almost confusing that you're saying, here's federal jurisdiction all over the place, but then you're just saying this very, which seems to be narrow, but I am extremely concerned that this seemingly narrow provision could be read very broadly. And the first thing that comes to mind when I read this is, oh my gosh, a state employee can't enforce invasive species rules that are federal. And that's very, very troubling. Because I think you have drafted something that's broader than the problem that you're describing to us. And I'm not going to get upset about speed limits, but I will get really upset about invasive species and other kinds of things like that. So I'm wondering if you could think about redrafting this in a way to meet your narrow concern without preventing state employees from enforcing federal laws, for example, that might have to do with invasive species.
Well, I don't. So what you're saying is that when the federal government imposes invasive species laws, even though those are the state's waters, they have to enforce them. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I
mean, isn't it the job of the state to develop invasive species laws? Aren't we doing ballast water for that very reason in a committee? Is it because the federal government won't do that, and so we're taking that forward? So we'd be actually, when those laws are promulgated, be enforcing state law.
Well, no, I'm maybe talking about federal laws that might have minnows coming from. I'm not, take ballast water out of it. There are all sorts of kinds of things where we might, and that's the problem. I can't anticipate
mm-hmm.
what might happen, but we don't want a fish that's sick, VHS for example, to get into any of our waters, and I think we all agree with that. And if I would want a state employee to be able to enforce any federal law that has to do with VHS, for example. So sometimes a law can have an unintended consequence, and I don't think that's the consequence you're trying to get at. So I'm wondering if you could not. I mean, I hear you wanting just to get a speed limit.
Well, Madam Chair and Madam Chairman, there is a bit broader than just the speed limit. You know, we have the aircraft use, the ATV use, and some things like that. But And let me also say that the federal government has imposed invasive species restrictions on lakes within the park, but they're not the navigable waters of the park. And that the federal and the state employees can certainly do that because they're not listed specifically in the navigable waters. As an example is on Little Trout Lake, which is an inland water of the park, not listed as navigable in the statute. They have outlawed the use of live bait, just as they have in the Quetico Park, which is in Canada. And you don't notice that I have that in this bill because, you know, I respect that. They don't have that. That isn't in state statutes that those lakes belong to us.
So I guess the point I'm trying to make is there is a whole group of federal laws that we might actually like and that we may actually agree
on
because we both want to protect the health of our waters. And I don't see that we would have any disagreement about that. So I don't want this to stop something that we both would agree with. And I think this is pretty broadly drawn that could have that impact. So it seems to me that if you are looking to do something, it should be narrowly drawn to address the issues that you want and not unintendedly to something that none of us might want.
Chairman.
Dale.
Hi. You know that I agree with you on the invasive species issue.
I know.
And so I'm sympathetic to what you're saying. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask you for your counsel on this and how you'd like to proceed on this. I mean, I'd like to move the bill forward. It's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm willing to take that under consideration and work with Representative Guinness immediately before the next committee to get to the root of the problem that she has described that I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But it is of great importance to the people who work and live in this area to get the rights of this state and the citizens back.
Okay. Representative Gill, and maybe there is a solution if an oral amendment would suffice. I know Representative Hanson, you had a suggestion.
Sure.
Maybe you'd like to share that.
All right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gill, I listened to your discussion of the existing law, and the word travel popped out at me that the rights reserved about travel. And I'm wondering if the travel or transportation are the words in the section, federal travel or transportation laws, if that was the amendment. And that would encompass, I think, all of the things that you were talking about, and then would still reserve, like, the Federal Migratory Bird Act or some of those acts and forth.
And Representative Cornish.
Representative Dill, this has got to go through the committee I'm on in public safety, and actually we could move it out of here and we could work on the language and tailor it just the way you want it and still worry about the other thing. I think it's easily fixable. The problem is there's double definition of navigable. There's federal navigable waters, and then there's navigable waters in the state, and rather than try to fix it all now, I'd be willing to work with Representative Dill and put it in a form that would have to be probably passed our committee.
Okay, thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Arginius.
It makes me very uncomfortable to move a bill like this out of this committee without fixing it. If that is what is going to happen in this committee, however, I would hope that the fix is to list what you don't want to happen and don't inadvertently be prescriptive of what you don't want to happen and don't capture anything else inadvertently, because I don't think we can sit here and think of what you might capture inadvertently. I even think travel is too big, because then somebody will come in and say, oh, just because I have zebra mussels on the bottom of my boat, you can't enforce it. Well, banana. I want them to be able to enforce that kind of thing. So, and I think you do too. And so I think this needs some substantial work.
I think, Representative Borghinius, you can face also the opposite problem when you're trying to list things that you don't want to happen. You could end up leaving something off that list that you don't want to happen, or something that you may not yet foresee that may become a problem later. So that problem kind of runs in both directions, and I was just thinking, as far as the suggestion that Representative Hansen made, at least that improves the bill and that it does narrow it down more to the intention that Representative Dill has. Representative Borghinius, you wanted to respond.
This is probably the hardest thing in this kind of language to anticipate anything. So he knows what problems he's trying to address specifically. When the next problem comes, he can add it to the list. But the real trick here is not to capture things you don't want to capture. Very difficult.
And Representative Dill, you want to respond?
Well, I'm in agreement with Representative Borghinius that, you know, the law of unintended consequences is always a problem around here. I want to move the bill out, and I will work with Representative Borghinius before the next committee hearing to try to narrow this focus down. And she'd already sent him, Representative Borghinius, you'd already mentioned this to me, but in the pace of this place, being that it's more like the last week of session rather than third week, this is where we're at the moment. So I don't sense that there's a problem that we have to bring it back to this committee, and we do have another committee, at least one, to go to. And so that's kind of how I feel about it in the whole thing. I agree with you, although in the case of zebra mussels, we've got state laws about, you know, transferring, moving those types of things in the state, and we certainly are aggressively enforcing them. And so I'm thinking it's more like something like VHS, because we already have state laws, and this doesn't prohibit the enforcement of those laws.
Representative Olin, you were first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to indicate that Representative Cornish and I are both on that committee, and I think we should just move this out and forward.
And Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, I'm empathetic to what you're trying to do as you described it, and we had a brief conversation about this, very brief, earlier today. There may be some other issues that overly broad language here may raise, and it's not your intention to raise any of those issues, and I do believe you in that. But I have to say, Mr. Chair, I'm very uncomfortable procedurally moving forward a bill without some kind of prescriptions that have been articulated here today. And even if they're awkward prescriptions, if there's going to be another committee that Representative Cornish and Olin serve on, at least they have some broad direction from this committee and can work within, you know, that perhaps imperfect direction. But I have to say, you know, it's not at all because I'm not empathetic Representative Dill at all, but I have to say that this language as it stands, I can't support it. I mean, I think we need to have some prescription, and I think this committee needs to exercise its rightful authority to at least do that if we're going to move a bill forward.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Dill.
I have an oral amendment. Maybe we can get it close enough that we can go to the next committee. On line 1.7, after the word federal laws, I got to read it out loud to myself first. So, a state employee shall not enforce federal laws pertaining to ATV use, snowmobile use, or aircraft use in the navigable waters within Voyageurs National Park.
Okay. So the amendment, again, as it reads, would be on line 1.7. On line 1.7, after federal laws, insert pertaining to ATVs, snowmobiles, or aircraft use. Okay.
Use of.
Okay. Pertaining to use of ATVs, snowmobiles, or aircraft.
And so, Mr. Chairman, I represent Virginia, so Representative Mariani, does that get us closer to where we need to be? Okay. That is my amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dill. And I agree that at least it narrows it down considerably from what it was and focuses the attention where it's intended to be. Anybody need to repeat the amendment? Everybody understand it? Okay. All those, any discussion of it before we take a vote? Oh, and we do have a testifier who would like to speak to it, Ms. Corey McNulty. And did you want to speak to the amendment, or should we, or to the bill itself? Okay, maybe we'll take a do the amendment first and do a vote on that, and then take your testimony. Again, everybody understands the amendment? Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion to fail, the amendment is adopted. And welcome, Ms. McNulty. Sorry, we didn't recognize you earlier, but welcome. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for an opportunity to speak today. My name is Corey McNulty, and I represent Voyageurs National Park Association, which is the group that helped establish Voyageurs National Park, and we continue as citizen stewards that support, protect, and promote the park. And I first want to thank you for the discussion and the comments today, and the concern about the broad language in the bill and how it's been narrowed through the amendment. When I learned about this legislation, I also held the belief that state conservation officers were enforcing federal regulations, National Park Service regulations in particular, in Voyageurs National Park. So what I needed to do first was make some calls and contacts to clarify how this law could impact visitor safety and the natural resources of Voyageurs National Park. So I contacted the National Park Service, Voyageurs National Park Chief Ranger, the very efficient conservation officer that Representative Dill has talked about, as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And what I found is that state conservation officers and state employees are not currently allowed, they do not have the authority, and they are not enforcing federal regulations within the navigable waters of Voyageurs National Park. And so, in essence, this legislation that's been introduced does not impact how the laws are enforced in the park. And I recognize that it was introduced with concerns about Park Service regulations and the amount of law enforcement in the park. And I think those concerns need to be addressed, but this law just will not reduce law enforcement, and it will not change the regulations of concern. My main concerns with the legislation were with the broad language. State employees, conservation officers who are deputized, can enforce Fish and Wildlife Service regulations, and I was concerned that that would prevent them from doing that job, even though they do it very infrequently in the park. I was also concerned about the potential of future interagency cooperation as it relates to border security, since the border runs through Rainy Lake right at the north edge of Voyageurs National Park. The amendment certainly has addressed those concerns very well. However, it's still my information that I have gotten from the folks on the ground enforcing the laws is that they do not have the authority to do that right now.
Okay.
And I'm happy to take any questions and provide information as best I can.
So, Ms. McNulty, you're saying that this legislation is redundant in your view then? Or
what I'm saying is this legislation, it's prohibiting state employees, yes, from, there isn't a law that prohibits state employees from enforcing those laws, but there isn't any authority already given to them, so they cannot. There's nothing on the books, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, that prohibits it. But there's nothing that allows them.
Okay. And Representative Dill, would you like to respond?
You shouldn't have any problem with the bill then. Because if they're not doing it, then this just clarifies for future generations of very efficient conservation officers that they can't do it. And the fact is that they have done it. And I've received the tickets. know, I've got them. Failure to display, you know, all these different things, violation of the speed limit over, you know, we're talking over since 1975. Certainly not since I was elected. But, you know, so really, the bill as amended really gets right at the heart of what Representative Lagunias brought up as an issue, and it clarifies for future generations of law enforcement that they're to respect the laws of the state of Minnesota, and not in these instances where the federal law conflicts with Minnesota's laws on the waters that we have not ceded, that they shall not enforce those limits. Now, the reason that the conservation officer, very efficient one particularly, is not out there enforcing the laws is because we've raised so much hell with the DNR over this that they've called the dogs off. That's the truth. That's how it happened. We've been on this for a decade, and we finally got somewhere, and they're starting to listen. Well, they are listening. But we want to make sure that in the future they all listen. That's the purpose of the bill. And when I say we've raised so much, us, the people that are specified in this law, public officials, are who I'm talking about raising the H-E-double-Q.
And Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McNulty, thanks for making the trip down. I found out you came from up north. I know it's the hall. I was. Oh, okay. I live in Bemidji. You said that you believe that this is redundant, and not that that would be unique to state law, but in this in this case, you said that it's redundant, thus and not necessary. Anecdotally, at least, Representative Dill claims otherwise. I have to agree with Representative Dill from my circle's influence. It seems as though this has been an issue. If, in fact, it is an issue, or not, depending on your perspective, what is the concern with actually passing it, especially when it's narrowed to specifically, you know, these three things? Why would we not pass it, at least for clarification?
Mrs. Nelson.
Representative Moe, so one thing that I should clarify is that state conservation officers are within the boundaries of Voyageurs National Park enforcing state laws. So they are doing that, and under this law it would continue. As I said earlier, my concern was about the unintended consequences of the language. I also have some concern about kind of a negative platform for Voyageurs National Park, honestly, because there are a lot of really exciting positive things happening with the park. There's still some concerns that need to be addressed, but that would be that's my underlying concern given the amendment that's been put forth at this point.
And Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McNulty, I was just kind of curious. I don't understand. Related to this map, are we talking about ATV and snowmobile use only on the trails, or are we talking about, and maybe Representative Dill is the one to answer this, or are we talking anywhere on Cabot, Togama Lake? That's one question. And then the other question from Ms. McNulty would be, who deputizes? You mentioned something about deputizes. Who does that? And then in that instance, are state officers enforcing federal law on behalf of the federal government?
Let me answer the first question, Mr. Chairman.
Sundale.
First off, only the water is at issue here. There is no issue about land. And so if you left where I live in Crane Lake and you tried to access the park, you can access the park via water. You can also access the park via land. You would not be able to access, as an example with the ATV, over the land, because that is not an issue. The park owns the land, and they have the right to make the rules. But you could access a lake of the navigable waters of the state by water from outside the park. And that's the issue, as an example, at Cabot Togama. The people at the Cabot Togama have resorts that run right up to the edge of the water that the park has decided they can't use ATVs on, even though those waters belong to the state. And on every other lake, Lake of the Woods is an example, Mille Lacs, Leech, Winnie, you can use an ATV on those water surfaces. So that I hope that clarified what you're saying. If an ATV has to go over land that's within the park, then they've broken a federal law, and they shouldn't be doing that. And we're not promoting that. That would be like saying they could go on a trail somewhere else in the state where they were prohibited. But what I'm saying is that if they can access those navigable waters that are listed in the statute by ATV without going over land that belongs to the park, then they should be able to do that. But I hope that answered the question.
And Representative Lagunia.
Thank you. The amendment helped immeasurably here. However, I think you're just puzzling about the aircraft part of it. Because I don't think there are state laws, much in the way of state laws with regard to aircraft. Our aircraft laws are federal FAA laws. And we may be, again, overreaching here, particularly with regard to safety. If they're not federal officers there in the state park, but there are state employees, there may be instances where we want to, for the safety of the public, be able to enforce aircraft laws. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I do think that there are questions there that I hope we can answer. I think the question you have is, can somebody land or not land? But not the question of how they land, which is probably federal law and not state law, because I don't think we have much to do with state law.
Well, I think you're exactly right. The FAA does regulate the use of aircraft, except that now the Park Service has decided to take it one step further. All certified pilots have to follow the rules of the FAA, which include distances from other persons, places, things, buildings, things of that nature. And frankly, aircraft are allowed to land on the park anywhere, essentially. Any of those navigable waters of the state, they can land anywhere. There are no restrictions on a privately run aircraft. I can land my airplane a million times on any of these lakes. But one commercial flight, trying to get one commercial float plane just like mine, coming from the airport out to deliver someone to a dock, the Park Service has taken the authority that is vested in the state under this state law, that when that aircraft touches down on the water, now they are on the waters of the state. They're not in the air of the federal government. And they have said that no commercial operations can operate from the main lake. So they come down under law of the FAA, touch down on the water, taxi into the dock, and the Park Service has now prohibited that. And they don't have the authority to do that on the water. And that's the purpose of aircraft.
Okay. Representative Scalzi had a second question that had not been answered. If you want to restate the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering who deputizes state enforcement officers to enforce federal law, and why would they do that, and at what time?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the federal government does deputize the state conservation officers, and my understanding is they're deputized specifically to enforce Fish and Wildlife Service regulations. There is apparently the Solicitor General stated that a special agent in charge needs to be with the conservation officers when they're enforcing those regulations. And so it's not used frequently, but for example, if they found, significant violations of the Migratory Bird Species Act or the Lacey Act, if there was a commercial fishing operation where they were catching significant amounts of fish in the park and selling them, they could use, they could do a special operation to enforce those regulations. And at this point, I don't think they're using that for homeland security, but given some of the changes, I could see an interagency cooperation. So again, I think my concern is the unintended consequences, and I guess generally that would be my concern with doing a redundant law, is what are the unintended consequences that we might see.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Dale.
And by virtue of the amendment, we eliminated that problem because we're not We're talking about the use of aircraft, boats, and ATVs, and it has nothing to do with migratory bird acts or commercial fishing or VHS or aquatic species or whatever other things. We've narrowed it down to these three items. And so, you know, I think that Ms. McNulty is exactly right on what she said, and I agree with you, except the fact that it doesn't have any bearing on the bill.
Next question. Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess cutting to the chase here then, it's whether that the Park Service has the authority to allow ATVs on the water when it's frozen or whether planes can land on those lakes or not, whether they can actually say that's not going to happen or not. And effectively this bill would keep the authority for that with the state, effectively, at least the policing of that authority. Am I wrong? Okay.
And then you have to add in, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Moe, you'd have to add in to those two items the idea that the speed limit is different, the state posted speed limit is different for snowmobiles. You didn't mention that. Because,
right. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Those three things. And, I mean, the Park Service will continue to do what they do, but this bill just doesn't allow for the conservation officers to enforce any laws that they oppose on us that, at least I believe, and state statute says, is improper.
Mr. Chairman, since these are Minnesota waters, we should have a jurisdiction there.
That is correct. And Mr. Chairman, just for the education of this group, you go back to the boundary waters in 1964. I think it was in 64 this happened. The state, when they participated in the establishment of the boundary waters, and it could have been in 78. There was the Wilderness Act in 64, and 78 they made the big changes. So it was somewhere in there. The state ceded both the land and the water and its beds to the federal government. But we learned our lesson and took our licking over that one. And when they made the park, they said, we're going to give you the land, but we're not ceding, as this statute says, we're not ceding the water and its beds. Those belong to us. And my bill says that they can't enforce, that our member, our employees can enforce laws that the federal government imposes on our waters in the case of aircraft, snowmobiles, and ATVs. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move my bill.
Okay. There are no further questions or seeing no further questions, Representative Bill renews his motion. That House File 3284 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass, and referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion prevails, the bill is passed.
Well, the chair is coming to the table. We need to move the minutes from the last meeting. Representative Charles, you moved the minutes from the February 26th meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved.
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move House File 3366 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Representative Eakin moves House File 3366 be recommended to pass and to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Chairman Eakin, welcome to this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is its intent is to streamline the process of recovering funds from the petrol fund for spills that occur. And it also addresses the issue of PVC pipes that break and as a result result in pollution problems and spills. This has been a problem with PVC pipes and as a result this legislation would allow the Petra Fund to be used to replace PVC pipe before the spills occur.
It's really a preventive measure, and it's designed to really save money in the long run. So instead of cleaning up the mess afterwards and replacing the PVC pipe with metal piping, to go out and find these PVC pipes and replace them before the spills occur. And homeowners, this is for private homeowners, and they would be informed of this, and it's believed that a number of them would come forward to have this done in order to avoid that possibility in the future. So I do have with me today Mr. Bob Krogman from the Petra Fund, who will further explain or answer any questions that members may have on this legislation.
Mr. Krogman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our folks are the fuel oil vendors, the folks who supply homes, farms with heating oil. Over the past couple of years, there's been a few incidences of, I'm suspecting 8 or 10, where the PVC piping that has been replaced, the homeowner most often will be remodeling their hollow basement or something. They'll take the steel pipe out, put a piece of PVC in with an elbow because it fits their redecoration. When you after a while, when you fill with fuel oil, you can dissolve the glue at that elbow. It lets go, you spill fuel oil in the basement, and you've got a mess. It can run down the drain, it can run through cracks in the floor. What this would do would say that the Petra Fund can reimburse up to $400 in a home for someone to come in, take that PVC out, and put a steel pipe in. Very simply that. That would prevent those types of incidences. We surveyed our members and asked how many PVC retrofitted fuel tanks are out there, and we don't get I can't give you an exact number. I have talked to some folks who have said, we are also operate a burner fix-it service. We've been in several homes. We think there is 8 to 10%. I've talked to other ones in the southern part of the state, for example, who said we've got none. So I can't tell you they're all have PVC or that none do. We speculate that there's probably 8 to 10% of the homes have been retrofitted with PVC. Thank you.
Any questions?
I just want to know the track of this bill. Is it going to go to Consumer Protection Division, Consumer Protection Committee?
Representative Guinness, it's going to Commerce and Labor, which I think has a subdivision on that. So.
That seems right.
It'd be up to the Chair of Commerce to decide which division it would go to. I think Representative McNamara had a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Eakin, is it legal to put PVC pipe in currently?
I believe it is. Yeah, Representative Eakin, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara, yes, I believe it is.
Mr. Krogman, you know...
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, as I understand it, the state mechanical code disallows PVC piping, but that is what is installed by a contractor or a plumber in those areas where the state mechanical code has been adopted, because that is jurisdictional. Some cities have adopted it, some haven't, as I understand it. So someone installing a furnace in a new house or putting in a new one because the old one went out, a contractor putting it in could not put in a PVC pipe, but the homeowner can.
Representative McNamara?
Well, Representative Eakin, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eakin, it seems to me we should clarify, instead of rewarding somebody to pay them to fix something that they may have skirted the law or the intent of the law, or the law might not apply to their jurisdiction, but should. I think the first thing we should do is clarify they should be using steel pipe, and then I'm trying to figure out. I got some fixes on a petrol fund I'd like to do, and they're unrelated to paying a homeowner $400. But that's a different issue. I'm trying to understand why we're not dealing with the issue of making sure we quit putting PVC pipe in. I happen to have a mother-in-law that where their house, they dumped a couple, or what was it, 1,200 gallons of fuel oil in their basement about 20 years ago. So I don't think we want to be doing any more of that. I think it was in Representative Thiessen's district, but anyway.
Representative Eakin.
And, Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I think that's a good point. We don't want the PVC pipe being put in from this point on. We could work on some legislation that would address that issue, but I don't think that would get at those PVC pipes that are currently out there. That would require some kind of incentive that this program would, or that this legislation would offer, in at least paying up to $400 for replacing it and avoiding greater costs in the future, which would also come out of the Petra Fund because the Petra Fund would be used for cleaning up the mess. So really, in the long run, this is going to, I think, save money for the Petra Fund. But I think you've got a good point about we don't want more PVC pipes being put in if it's going to result in problems in the future. So thank you.
Actually, Representative Gardner, you have an...
You know what, you could skip me for a minute while I formulate my question. So let my neighbor, Representative Scaldi.
Representative Scaldi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if this isn't... I mean, I'm assuming that this is not contractors doing this. Is this typically the homeowner that thought, well, they know how to install a furnace, so they'll just do it the way they think they know how? And is it just kind of... They don't know that they did the wrong thing? Is that what you're finding out there?
Mr. Grugman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, but it's not the furnace. It's not the tank. It's just a piece of pipe.
Yeah, they know.
And they do not know that, first off, the mechanical code might not allow it, and secondly, that it may be problematic. They're doing it because it's easy to do, and they can do it themselves.
Still formulating, Representative Gardner?
I think I'm formed. Is it my turn?
Yep.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, I really want to go home, but I got to ask this question. Is this legislation meant to overcome barriers to people doing stuff that they should have done in the first place, or are we dealing with people who have put the step in, left, and then there's somebody who's stuck with it? I guess I'm curious if, by I guess the way I'm reading it, not knowing anything about it, is that we may give up to $400 per person to fix something that they should do themselves. I've got that wrong.
Representative Eakin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, I'm sure it's a combination of some people who've purchased homes where these PVC pipes have been put in prior, and people who are currently living in these homes. But I think as far as those people should be doing this on their own, again, it's not going to be done unless there's some incentive for them to do so. I think that this is what would do that, and again, prevent future problems that would result from the PVC pipes failing. As I understand it, there are no penalties for putting in the PVC pipes, so there's no disincentive to having them removed, and this would create an incentive for that. And I think would be more effective at getting at the issue, because there are many of these homes out there, and there's no way to find out. Penalties wouldn't do it. I think it would take an incentive that would bring these people in that would ask this to be done, because they're not going to bear the full cost.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
This will be going to environmental finance, I think, right?
Well, it's going to commerce next.
But eventually it will go to... Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll
wait.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other questions from members? Representative Eakin, do you have any other testifiers? Or are you ready to summarize?
Yes, ready to summarize and just renew my motion that House File 3366 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Do we have another testifier? Okay, come forward. Thank you, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
Welcome to the committee. My name is Joel Fisher. I'm the director of the Petra Fund program at the Department of Commerce.
And I just wanted to give you a brief, the department's take on this bill. The department has one concern with the provision regarding the PVC piping, in that this is a difficult bill to determine what the fiscal impact to the Petra Fund would be. The number of tanks or homes around the state that have the PVC piping is unknown at this point. There are estimates from the petroleum marketers, but it's still those are guesses. It is also difficult to determine what cost would be saved. Even if you estimate that there's a cost of so many million dollars, it's difficult to determine how much money we would actually save. The range of what this cost is, cleanup these type of leaks, it varies wildly. So widely. If you have any questions, I can answer.
Mr. Fisher, is the department preparing a fiscal note? Or?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we are in the process of preparing a fiscal note.
Before we go any further, any questions, Mr. Fisher? Any questions? Staff informs me that the finance committee that it may go to from commerce may be energy finance, because they may have the jurisdiction on the Petra Fund. So, but that will, it has to go to commerce first, so I'm sure that'll be worked out on the way. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Thank you. Representative Eakin.
Mr. Chairman, members, and again, I think this is legislation that will prevent some problems in the future. Maybe we can look at penalties and making sure that it's not allowed in the future, and penalties can certainly achieve that goal. But as far as going back and removing these PVC pipes and putting in the metal piping that will prevent these problems, you do need an incentive of this nature. So with that, just ask for your support and renew my motion.
Representative Eakin renews the motion that House File 3366 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion is approved. Any other business before the committee? Meeting adjourned.